is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and Truth Quest programs are archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. And while I'm at it, I've also started another program on Oracle Broadcasting, so if you want to catch me on Saturdays from 1 to 3, or 11 to 1, excuse me, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mountain Time Zone, I'm also doing a Truth Quest on that one, and so all my programs are still linked through via my www.gimmesometruth.info, so I'm hoping that those who want to catch both can do so. And my co-host this evening is Katie O'Brien. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
Hi. And our special guest today is Clifford Clift, and I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And I also want to state that we also have an email, so if you have any questions for the program, you can get a hold of us at khen.dj@gmail.com. And I also wanted to mention that we have coming up next, whoops, I better not mention it because I just spaced it out who I have coming up next week, so I'll have to look it up on my website. I'll say it later. So, but anyways, Clifford Cliff received his education at the University of Northern Colorado and graduated in 95, speech communications, military, and he had went to Brush High School, and he served in the military and U.S. Army Security Agency, and looks like intelligence, and stationed in Massachusetts, Eritrea, and Texas. But he joined MUFON, and this is what we're going to be talking about, and this is the Mutual UFO Network. And since 95, he's been a member and on the international board since 2000. And he's a trained field investigator involved with all aspects of symposiums since 2004. He's led a team in creation of symposium guidelines for all states. And he developed a lifetime membership program with MUFON and assisted MUFON board development of a business plan. So he's got quite a work experience with the MUFON, and he's also, you're currently head of MUFON, but is there somebody that's coming in to replace you soon, Clifford?
Well, I hope so.
Well, some of them. I saw when I went back in the history on MUFON, he'd been there heading the MUFON for a number of years. So,
yes, I'm the fifth international director for MUFON, Melody. I took over January 25th of this year from James Carrion, who had taken over from John Schussler.
Uh-huh.
And John Schussler had taken over from Walt Andrus. So that's in 40 years, that's where we are at 41 years. I am now the international director.
Well, I got to meet up with you at the MUFON, is how you said it, conference in Denver this last July. And which was quite interesting. I'd never been to one of those events and got to learn quite a bit. And it sparked an interest I'd forgotten that I had back in the 70s and early 80s on UFOs. But I think what I'd like to see, if you'd want to get in and explain a little bit about the history of what MUFON is about and why you got into it, and any other tidbits you'd like to add.
Okay, sure, yeah. MUFON started in 1969, Melody. We were the result of NICAP, the National Investigative Committee on Aerial Phenomenon's demise in 1969. We took over the reins of the investigative organization for the UFOs. and we are the largest UFO investigative organization in the world. There are other agencies that take sightings and have reports given to them, but we're the only ones that investigate. Over that 40 years, Walt Andrus and John Schussler have brought it up to where we are today, and now we are very excited about all the new technologies and the equipment that we're using to investigate the UFO sightings. We have 800 trained field investigators worldwide. And when I say trained, that means that they, to become a field investigator for MUFON, you have to buy a manual and then take the test. And if you pass the test, which you can do very easily, I'm sure, you have to learn about meteorology, astronomy, radar, investigative techniques, and numerous other disciplines that are required to become a trained field investigator. Then they can go out and investigate. We assign them cases, and we average about 500 sighting reports a month currently. And of the 500, our investigators have determined that about 80% of them, or 400, are something prosaic, something that can be defined, such as planets, black ops aircraft, meteors, something that's fairly normal or natural. But the other 20%, the other 100, pretty exciting stuff. And of that 100, 25 of them usually are with people are within less than 500 feet. There may be a landing. We average about 12 landing sites, 12 landings reported to us each month, various places all over the United States and sometimes the world. So we are pretty active in our investigative techniques and knowing how to do it and coming up with what the real situation is.
So are you saying that most of your active members are in the United States?
Yes, we have 3,000 members, and there's probably 2,500 of them are residents of the U.S. The balance of them are in 25 other countries of the world.
Because when I start looking for evidence, I mean, there's a lot of sightings that take place outside of the United States.
Oh yes, Melody, yeah. We, France and Italy both have investigative organizations also, and they will average as many sighting reports a month as we do. So there's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,500 to 2,000 sighting reports a month. Now, when we get down to the 20% and the 5% of that, we don't know how many of them are really the same object because they move so fast. Might see it in Europe, and 5 minutes later they see it over Arizona. And we don't know how many of those are the same object.
How do you divide them into categories? I mean...
That's a good question, Melody. We have...
That's Katie.
Oh, Katie, I'm sorry.
No
Excuse
problem.
Me. We have categories 1, 2, and 3. Category 1 is defined as the object is a light in the sky, and it's moving around, darting around. Category, and those are really hard to investigate because there's no point of reference. There's no definitive outline of the object. So it's kind of difficult to investigate those because it might only be a 10 or 15 second light in the sky that we get the report on. But category 2 is then we are in a lot closer proximity. The witness is in a very, well, they might be within 500 feet of the object. They might be multiple witnesses, which is really a good thing. Aerial and ground observation. When I say aerial, I'm talking about pilots. And radar. And then category 3 is really the one where we probably have entities involved. There's physiological effects on the witness that's within very close proximity to the witness. And there's, again, multiple witnesses. So we categorize them in those three areas, 1, 2, and 3.
I noticed that on your, to report a UFO sighting, one of the things you asked was to describe their feelings, reactions, and actions during and after the sighting object.
Right. This is very important because so many times there is, when we have a report of a sighting that's really close, the people are mesmerized. They have a feeling of great peace, and it's very serene for them. But in some instances, also on the other hand, we have people that are absolutely terrified. But they usually are terrified more after the fact than during the event. So it's how did you feel is important. Animal reactions are important. Animals have a higher sense of hearing and sometimes intelligence than people. But the animals and the people, how they react to the situation is extremely important.
And I understand that if they want to report one of the UFOs, they can go to your website at www.mufon, that's MUFON.com, or you also have an 800 number. That is 888-817-2220.
That's right, and we have a new website that is still under somewhat of construction, but they just, if you want to report a sighting, it's right on our home page, and you just click on it, forms there, fill it out. And we have people that are watching this all the time so that we know if we have a major event, such as Stephenville, Texas, or the Phoenix Lights, or that type of thing. So we can have our investigators on site as within 24 hours.
Well, I noticed that on October 31st, there were 10 sightings over the U.S., but on your website, they didn't necessarily have the time that they were happening. Do most of these happen at night?
That seems to be the logical assumption that we make. But in fact, many of our sightings, and I would say 40% up to 50% of our sightings are daylight events. The reason that the nighttime is probably seems to be more prevalent is because of the lights that are involved with the object. And people are not working at that time, and they have a tendency to be more outside, especially if it's warmer.
Now, what would you recommend for taking a photograph? Because one of the main complaints is that they're grainy. How can you take a good picture or video without having atmospheric distortion?
That's a tough one, and we get a lot of pictures and videos from home cameras and digital cameras that don't seem to focus on the exact object. They seem to focus before they're there or beyond, and it does make a grainy picture. It's really difficult. The old 35-millimeter cameras still are the best to take pictures of UFOs. They're less able to be hoaxed, for one thing. And two, you can adjust your camera. It's not automatic.
Now, Clifford, one of the things that I noticed at the symposium, you have some very highly trained professionals that are involved with your organization.
Oh, yes, definitely. Melody, we have... That was Melody, not Kate, right?
Right.
Okay, all right. Melody, we have 40... more than 40 consultants with their PhDs in various disciplines who are available for us to utilize when we have something of significance. For an example, one of our people, Chuck Modlin, is retired from Lawrence Livermore Labs and has created and developed and built all kinds of secret stuff. And he knows the Geiger counters, the electromagnetic equipment, light meters, and all the things that we use. He knows those just like we know what we do every day. So he's able to lend his expertise to help us get to a better understanding of exactly what the object is.
And I got to talk a little bit with Mark D'Antonio.
Mark D'Antonio is our photo analyst back on the East Coast. Excuse me, and Mark is an expert. He does a lot of work for the government under contract. And he does our video. He's our head video and photo analysis person. So he's able to term. A lot of times what people do is they'll take a picture. They didn't see anything, but they have the picture developed, or they look at it on their computer, and here's this object in there. And so many times it's an insect that's flying by, and it looks like a blur, like a flying saucer or something like that. He's great at picking up that type of information.
And he's also, I noticed that he's kind of cross-trained, too. I mean, here you have an astronomer and then somebody that is familiar with, I'm not even quite sure how to describe his occupation or his training in ocean work.
Yeah, he does a lot of work for the military and the government with filming in water, on water, underwater. He does a lot of analysis of photos for them, but he also does it for us. And photo analysis is what we call him. I don't know if what his pedigree is with that, but that's what he does for us and for numerous other people.
Uh-huh. So did MUFON take the place of like Project Blue Book, or is this something outside of it? How did that happen?
Well, that's, Melody, that is really good. You know, in 1969, the government, or the U.S. Air Force, closed Project Blue Book, which was the Air Force's investigative arm of the UFO phenomenon. Prior to that was Project Grudge, and prior to that was Project Sign. And they had numerous cases that were unidentified. And I'm saying 20% or better were unidentified. Well, then after they closed Project Blue Book, they had Dr. Condon from the University of Colorado. CIA and the Air Force gave him University of Colorado $500,000 in 1970. To do an analysis of all of what they had done and the research that they had done in the UFO phenomenon. And the results were that they are not a threat to the national security, and there's no sense to continue this project. So Project Blue Book and the Condon Report were then done. The sad thing about it is that Dr. Condon did not believe in the UFOs at all, and that's the attitude that he went into the project with, and some of the members of Project Blue Book even quit that attitude about that. Anyway, when they say they don't pose a threat to the national security, they're not saying they don't exist. They're saying they exist, but they're not a threat. That's the underlying current of what they had said. Excuse me. So after that, NICAP had been investigating the phenomenon also. And after the 1969 NICAP went under and Project Blue Book went under, there was no other investigative organization available. And Walt Andrus and John Schussler started MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, to do the investigations. Just because the government, the U.S. Air Force, said they don't pose a threat and that we're closing up and we're not going to investigate them anymore, that didn't mean the unidentified flying objects stopped flying around. No, they continued, and the U.S. Air Force continued to investigate, and so did the CIA. And we have documents that have been released to us from the Freedom of Information Act that states that they are continually investigating these objects.
We're talking with Clifford Clift, who heads the MUFON network, and who I got to meet this summer at the MUFON Symposium in Denver. Now, they have those all over the country. And is there any of them coming up anytime soon?
Yes, some of the states across the United States state has its own chapter of MUFON, and we have a state director. I have currently 54 states. That doesn't sound very good. I have 50 states with state directors, and these individuals will from time to time hold a conference within their state. Pennsylvania MUFON, for an example, just had one here 2 weeks ago, but the international symposium we hold once a year. 2010 was Denver. 2011 will be Orange County, California, and 2012 will be right outside of Cincinnati, across the river in Kentucky. So we do have these symposiums annually. Top speakers are there on UFO subjects, and we just have a great time.
And do you select those locations because of the amount of activity is there, or how is that selected?
Melody, we select the states by their ability and their volunteers. MUFON has approximately 3,000 members worldwide. We have 3 employees. All the rest are volunteers.
And how can somebody come and volunteer?
You have to be a member of MUFON, and you can join MUFON by getting on our website, www.mufon.com, and you can join. It's $35 a year for electronic journal and $50 a year for the hard copy, and you get 12 issues of our journal, very professionally done, and it's a good publication. Probably one of the foremost publications on UFOs in the world. And you become a member. Then when you're a member, you can apply to take the field investigator test. And when you do that, then you can become a field investigator. So that's the volunteer process that we have.
You know, one of the things that I have to wonder about, and this is, I recently did an interview with Leslie Keene, who had recently written a book, and oh my goodness, it left my mind of what it was just a few weeks ago, but it was on UFOs and the 5% of according to her, of the sightings that were unexplained. But we keep using the term UFO. Do you ever have consistent reports of things that you know that are identified, that you know that are of a nature that people, I mean, what you're looking for, as far as whether it's terrestrial, extraterrestrial, that, you know, can do these things that seem to be superhuman or super technology. Are you following what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, if I am, I will explain as I think, you said. And we do have a lot of, in the last 20 years, we've had a significant amount of black ops aircraft that have been developed in Area 51 and Groom Lake and other areas that defy logic for our eyes based on what we understand aircraft to be.
And what do they look like?
Some of them are triangular shaped. To give you an example, the B-2 bomber, if you look at that coming directly at you, you know you saw a UFO, a flying saucer. The stealth aircraft, the same way, the F-117. So, yes, these craft are there, but we still do not have an aircraft that is quiet. We still do not have an aircraft that can make a 90-degree turn at 3,000 miles an hour. We still do not have an aircraft that can fly 10,000 miles an hour and stop instantaneous and hover above the ground 100 feet, 15 minutes, and then be gone. We still don't have that technology, but we do have a lot of advanced technology that many people will see and think, wow, that's a UFO, when in fact it isn't.
Do you have, do you access satellites in regard to their pictures and what has been spotted here?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Do you ever access satellite information in regard to sightings and them moving from, say, an Earth atmosphere into outer space?
Oh, yes.
Past the satellites?
Yes, definitely. We have numerous space shuttle, for an example,
mm-hmm.
Information, pictures that have been taken that show the UFO leaving the Earth's atmosphere, making speeds that were unbelievable. We have a lot of satellite information. To give you an example, I'm sure Leslie Keene, when she was talking to you, discussed the Tehran, Iran incident in the 70s.
Briefly, yeah.
And that was seen. A personal friend of mine worked for the Jet Propulsion Lab, and he was in charge of the satellites that are stationary, that looking down on the United States or looking down on Europe or the Middle East or wherever. And they had the objects on, they had all three of the objects on satellite in Tehran, Iran. So, yes, that does happen. It's usually a fluke that we get that information from the government, or they don't mean to do it, and they did, and then said, oops, I'm sorry, we shouldn't have done that.
How much do you think the government is actually hiding in regard to what they know about what's going on with our satellites?
Well, with the satellites, you can bet that that is classifications above top secret. You can, we're now getting France and Brazil and Peru and Chile and the UK that are coming, the government's coming out with the information that they have, but they still haven't released the information that they have from the satellite technology that they're using. Even though they're releasing all this stuff in some of the other countries, U.S. is still ignoring it, and maybe it'll go away, I guess.
Do they have are you aware of them having the ability to cloak these planes or whatever they, you know, that's being used?
Well, yes, they have paint technology now that that will these up in the daylight, they will take on the color of the sky or the clouds. They're chameleons. They change colors as they fly so that people from the ground looking up can't see them. It looks just like a cloud or looks like a blue sky. The stealth one F-117 is a black or sometime camouflage just for the ground cover, but when they fly, you don't see them. And they have technology to prevent that. And, of course, the stealth technology for radar is obvious that we're able to do that. Interesting where that came from, but then that's the way it is.
And so you don't hear, do you hear them then if they're flying?
If they're not too high, you'll be able to hear them, yeah. Of course, you look up, you can't see anything. I hear airplanes all the time, and I look up, and I can't see them if they're a jet because they're going too fast.
Yeah, I've noticed that myself. So how? Where do you think this is going to go with this? I mean, because one of the things that was brought up at the closing of the conference was, you know, it seemed to be pretty unanimous that everybody said that they didn't feel disclosure was going to take place, and yet I hear so many people out there thinking that it is, and yet I don't see what would be in it for the military to disclose unless we back them in a corner.
Well, even backing them in the corner, give you an example, Melody, of one of the things that happened. U.S. Air Force denied that Area 51 existed. And in front of a federal U.S. senators had a committee hearing to discuss this type of thing. And the Air Force colonel denied that Area 51 existed, and there were photos on the table in front of everybody taken by the Russians that showed that Area 51 existed, and yet they still denied it. So, you know, with when the proof is right there in front of them and they still deny it.
Maybe they're on drugs.
They might be on something, but it's UFO classification within the military and the government is far and beyond any classification that we know of. And it's just there is a group of people that are keeping it quiet. Now, when I say that, I'm not trying to be a conspiracist, but let me preface my statement with a story about Barry Goldwater, who in 1997, I believe it was on Larry King Live, and we also have documents from him talking about this too, but he indicated that he wanted to go to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to see this hangar that was supposed to house artifacts from UFOs. Now, at that time, he was senator, and he was a on the Armed Forces Committee and a personal friend of Curtis LeMay, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Well, he went to the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and started to go in, and a captain in the Air Force stopped him and said, "Sorry, sir, you can't go in there." He said, "Well, you know who I am. I'm Barry Goldwater, senator, and I'm on the Armed Forces Committee." He says, "I'm sorry, sir. You're going to have permission from flag officer, and I understand that to be three or four or five star general or equivalent." So being friends with Curtis LeMay, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a five star general, he went to Curtis LeMay and he asked Curtis, he says, "I want to go into that hangar. Is there any chance you can get me in there?" And he wouldn't let me in. And he says, "No, I can't." And he said, "Don't ever ask me again." And Barry said, "That's the first, we were good friends, that's the first time I've ever seen him mad at me." And he said, "Don't ever ask again." He says, Curtis LeMay says, "I don't have clearance high enough to get in there." Now, a five-star general, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the President of the United States don't have the authority to get in there. Who has the authority? There is somebody that's calling the shots higher up than these folks.
Okay, but he didn't say that he hadn't seen the inside of it. He just said he didn't have clearance to get in there?
That's correct.
Because one of the things that kind of struck me is, do you guys get to talk to any of the people that were involved with the Disclosure Project, that really were involved in some of the aspects of maybe Area 51?
We do talk to a lot of them. We have talked to many of the military. We have in our archives, we have numerous documents from generals all the way down at nuclear bases where they have, in fact, these UFOs have been prevalent and present at these nuclear facilities, and numerous generals. As a matter of fact, Melody, the first chairman of the first leader of the CIA, Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter, was the first, 1948-51, was in charge of the CIA. He belonged to NICAP, our predecessor, the National Investigative Committee on Aerial Phenomenon. He was on their board of directors. We have direct quotes from him saying, "There are things flying in and out of our atmosphere that have technology that we don't understand, and stopping short of saying they're not of this earth." But some of the military people have gone that far and say that these are extraterrestrial.
Well, I listened to an interview where you mentioned that you actually feel that there are extraterrestrials involved with some of these.
Oh, it's most certainly. Yes, I certainly do. I am convinced that there are beings from other places in the universe, and As much as I would like to think that I am the center of the universe, I am not. And there are things out there that we have no concept of that don't defy the law of physics, but they're beyond the knowledge that we have of physics. So there's other things out there that are able to do things and go places, and they may be 1,000 or 100,000 years older than we are, and look where we've come in just the last 100 years.
Now, what about an interdimensional?
That is a good one, because there is some philosophies by some of the ufologists, Jacques Vallée, for one of the foremost authorities on extraterrestrial, and he believes that they are interdimensional. And I'm not sure exactly what that means, other than as a kid growing up and reading all the funny things that you do with science fiction, I'm thinking somebody's walking along right beside me, but in a different dimension. Well, I don't know that that's what it is. I don't know that I really understand what interdimensional means. So until I can get a handle on that, I can't say they're interdimensional, because I don't understand what it is.
Well, how about time travelers?
Well, I'm not so sure that's not close to what we're talking about.
Think that a time traveler would be an interdimensional?
I don't know why it wouldn't be, because I don't know the definition, the true definition of interdimensional. I know what we think it might be here on Earth, but maybe that's different in space, and I don't know.
One of the other questions that was brought up at the close of that conference was the fact that, you know, most of the people there on the board had thought that, if I'm recalling it correctly, that they thought that they felt that there was, you know, like you feel on there may be extraterrestrial or something of that sort, but one of them didn't state it in such a way, and it was one of them that was involved, and I believe it was Mark, and what that made me kind of wonder is, you know, and I'm sure because of clearances and all these other things, and this is what I've always half suspected, because so many of, you know, the percentages are identified technology. There may be stuff out there that our government is so much further advanced in that we haven't a clue yet.
Oh, I agree. I think the scientific field that's involved with the government has developed technologies and things that we have no concept of, and they want to keep it a secret. Because they're afraid that some other country is going to get that information and be ahead of us, I guess. That's the only reason I can think that they keep everything so secret.
Well, I have a hard time with that one a little bit on the other countries, because I see so often that they exchange information and they work together and then pretend on the other side that they don't get along.
Oh, most certainly. Yes, most certainly. I can remember back when I was in Eritrea, which is the northern province of Ethiopia, when I was back in the 60s when I was in the army, I had a top secret crypto clearance, and so I was privy to a lot of cryptic stuff, and I was able to read the CIA report weekly. And to give you an example, the CIA said they would put a list of the number of missiles that the Russians had, nuclear warhead missiles, and the number of missiles the U.S. had. And we would have twice as many as they would have, but the next week I would read in Time magazine that the government disclosed that Russia has two times more missiles than we do, and we've got to get on the stick and get things going, because if we don't, they're going to be able to bomb us out into oblivion. Well, it's just exactly the opposite of what the CIA report was saying. So, yes, disinformation and political information can definitely not be trusted.
I'm also finding that when I go back and start looking at some of the sci-fi movies, that so much of the technology that came out in some of them is here, and it just makes me, knowing human nature, that if they've thought of it, they're out there working on it.
Exactly, exactly. Look at Dick Tracy's watch that he talked to. We thought that was real. You probably don't remember Dick Tracy.
No, I remember. We're in that bracket.
Well, Dick Tracy had that watch that you could talk to, and I thought that was really far out, but we're not that far from it.
Well, I think we've actually surpassed it, because basically you have that and more in connection to the world, and you carry it in your pocket.
Well, that's true, yeah. I had a real estate company for 35 years, and I was one of the first ones to get computers, and it was a big box of thing that couldn't do anything. My little droid phone does more than that computer did I had back in the 70s.
And you had to keep them cool because they would burn up.
I know. I had to blow on mine all the time.
So once you step down from this position with MUFON, what are you going to do in capacity with the organization? Go back to what you were doing before, or?
Well, Melody, that you're the second person that's asked me that today. And I will never leave the field of ufology, because I just would be excited the day that our government and the military admit that they exist. That would be just tremendous. The technology that they have, these UFOs, is so much further advanced than what we have. Can you imagine taking a 25-ton object and it accelerate from ground, being on the ground, going up into the sky 5,000 miles an hour, making no noise, and be gone. The technology to move that much, that weight, would be phenomenal. And some people are saying for something, a 25-ton object to be moved, if we could capture the technology that drives that machine, that there would be enough energy to light up like the city of Denver. So it would be a tremendous boom to the world.
Maybe
Earth.
That's why the government is hiding it.
Well, I'm quite certain it is, because if we didn't have to rely on oil and gas and coal and all that kind of stuff, there'd be a lot of people out of jobs.
So who are some of your favorite people that are involved with? I mean, I'm sure you like them all, but I mean, you get to work rub shoulders with a lot of interesting people, and some of them with some incredible, outstanding backgrounds. Give us an example of some of these.
Well, obviously there are journalists that write about the stuff. Then we have the scientists that are involved with it, although limited because of the stigma that's put on UFOs, and universities are funded by money, so they don't really come out and say too much. But the people that really excite me are the Robert Bigelows, Bass Aerospace, and Dr. Colm Kelleher, who is his assistant. They're the ones that are putting up the industrial park in space, so that things can be manufactured in space without gravity, and significant things. For an example, I believe it's Canada that has developed a glass that has a tensile strength stronger than steel in space with no gravity.
I was actually watching a film footage on something, and I'm not sure. It was some kind of a science. They send out little science films each day, and it was about something that was created out of carbon that they were possibly wanting to make a tether to go to these space stations, and that they would have tensile strength that would far surpass most anything that, you know, we're aware of at this point, and be and yet still be very light. And it would seem to be something that they've already developed. It's just a matter of being able to, you know, make something that would go that far so they could use it like an elevator. And then they were having some kind of a project out in the desert to see who could make something that could climb up a strand like an elevator. And there were several of them that had some pretty interesting inventions that did it.
Yeah, there's some incredible things going on. And the people that have... Robert Bigelow is one of our strong supporters, an aerospace company, and what he wants to do is to develop the propulsion system that drives these UFOs so that he can get to space better and easier than his competitors. Now that NASA is not going, they sent their last shuttle up tomorrow?
Well, it might be delayed.
Oh, okay. Well, for the election?
No, some problem.
Oh.
The shuttle itself.
Okay.
Now, you were describing something in one of your interviews about, I believe it was somewhere in northern Colorado, where they were viewing these UFOs taking off with regularity. Is that correct? No?
It not familiar.
Okay. Well, maybe.
I might have said it, but I don't remember it.
Well, and I can't tell you which program, because sometimes I'm kind of like doing a crash course and, you know, going through information so that I can...
Well, you do a very good job, by the way.
Well, Clifford, what is your most memorable investigation here on the Front Range?
Well, Katie, that's a good one. That's the most memorable one that I have was a hoax. It was we proved to the witness that they were pelicans flying at night, white pelicans over the city of Fort Collins.
Mm-hmm.
And we investigated, and they made a sighting report, and they had a V-shape of, I don't know, 15 UFOs flying over Fort Collins every night.
Is that a normal path for pelicans?
Well, the pelicans don't have a path. They have airways that they fly.
Is that a normal airway for a pelican?
Well, wherever the airwaves are right for them, that's where they go.
Oh, okay.
So, anyway, this was at night. We were sitting on the patio looking up, watching, and sure enough, here they come. And I knew right away what they were, but you don't just jump in and say that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, at the end of the, we said, well, let's check. So we did some more checking and that type of thing, checked with the Game and Fish, because I live in the country, so I have a Christmas tree farm, really, after I got out of real estate. That's what I do now. So we live in the country, and I'm familiar with the geese and the pelicans and the migratory birds. So I've watched this stuff, and that's exactly what it was. But they were too low, too small. If they were UFOs and they were that low and small, they wouldn't have made a lot of sense. But anyway, we told them what it was, and they absolutely would not believe us that they were pelicans. But sure enough, winter set in, and they didn't see them again. So, but the white pelicans, when the lights of the city shine up on them, they do look like orbs moving across the sky.
And especially in a group, in a
formation. Yeah, well, they fly in a V formation.
So I just want to say again that we have Clifford Cliff, who leads the MUFON. Now, is that the national or international MUFON?
International. MUFON is the international organization.
Okay, and so you and you're going to be active until what, January? Is that, or are you out of it already as far as the leader?
Oh no. I'm here At least till 2012, and maybe longer.
Oh, okay, then I misunderstood that. I'm sorry.
No, okay. You can't get rid of me that quick, Melody.
Well, I thought that that wasn't very much time for you to get to be in there, because you just came in last January, but somewhere I got, I don't know, I thought they already picked the person that would follow you.
No, we have not.
Okay.
My predecessor is not named.
Well, that's good to hear. I don't know where I pick that one up. Okay, so, but there's a lot of authors that show up to these symposiums, and many of them have written about prior events and one of them was Lena Moulton Howe, and she got into what I really liked about her presentation this time, because I've seen her before, but she brought a person with her that was involved with the English, and
Burroughs.
Yes, John Burroughs. And that was one of the things that, you know, these guys that were all saying that they, you know, believe that there's something going on out there, he seemed to be one that was pretty convincing.
John Burroughs and that whole Rendlesham Forest event that happened in England in the 80s is a very significant event. And there's something that Colonel Hault, the base commander, even to this, well, now that he's out of the military, most of the time when they're in the military, they won't discuss the UFO phenomenon. But once they're out and haven't signed an oath saying that they can't talk about it, they'll talk about it after they're out of the military. And we've got generals that are talking to us about it. So, yes, that Rendlesham Forest was a very significant event.
How does some of them have to sign
non-disclosure?
Yeah, non-disclosure, and other ones don't if they're high up in the military or in clearance, or does it depend upon the clearance?
Many times it's case specific. For an example, when I left the military, I said I wouldn't say anything about what I was doing for like 30 years or something like that. And obviously that time has passed. I got out in 1965. So just for your listeners, by the way, I went back to college and got my degree in 1995.
Oh,
so
congratulations.
I don't want them to get the dates confused if they're thinking about, well, wait a minute, he went to college, he graduated in 95. Okay. So anyway, I'm sorry I brought that up, but that I thought it might be a point.
No, that's good.
the non-disclosure, or you can't talk about that type of thing. In many instances, for an example, a person without a top secret clearance sees something, and it's an event that happens in a military base. They might say to them, okay, you can't talk about this again. And if there's nothing that says after they leave the military that says that they can't talk about that, then there's not a problem.
So what if they do speak about it, and what do they usually do to them?
Well, I think they kill them.
Really?
No.
I mean, I've heard that. I don't know.
No.
I was buying it 100%.
No, they really don't know. I have not heard anybody that has been prosecuted from the military that disclosed any information about UFOs. Number one, if they did, that would indicate that there's something to it.
So the chances of them disappearing are probably even better then.
Yeah, they might come up missing. Yeah, that's a potential. But I think it would have to be a very significant event that they're talking about.
You have to wonder about how they can keep in, I mean, with the way they have clearances and compartmentalization and that kind of thing, how they can even figure out what they're doing. Because, I mean, it's almost like, even the guys at the very top, the way you hear them speak at times, as if, you know, they don't have as much ability to like you said, with Goldwater and that and the general that was involved, you have to wonder at times if they really have as much access to information as they think they do.
Well, I think in many instances you're exactly right. They may not have information. To give you an example, Chuck Modlin, the guy that you work for the Lawrence Livermore Labs, was in charge of a group that was building a secret, top secret listening device. And he had 14 engineers working for him. And each one of them were compartmentalized so that they were just working on one aspect. And I'm going to say they were working on a transistor or they were working on some digital part. They had no clue what the rest of the group was doing or what the ultimate project would be. So, you know, they can talk about having worked on something like a transistor. Well, what does that mean? Now, if you're talking about a listening device that you can put in a wall that blasts out every 24 hours all the information that gleaned from the place that it's been put, they just don't know. So it's very compartmentalized.
And I've seen some kind of shenanigans that takes place between some of these corporations that get some of these projects where they may be making something and then they lose it and it goes on to the next. And again, you know, there's such competition out there taking place. And then you have the different countries that may be involved in this now, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. There may be a coordinated effort between England and the U.S. on a certain type of satellite. But how the government's doing it now, it's my understanding is they're hiring contractors like Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, whatever it might be, and they're hiring them to do a specific job, and the specific job that they're doing they can keep very secret because it's proprietary within their own organization, and the government doesn't have to answer to the public that way.
And doesn't it also make it so that they can kind of hide some of the funds, in a sense?
Oh, Melody, there's so much money in the black ops that within the government, and nobody has a clue what that stuff is or what it's about. If we knew how much money was going into the military and the black ops from all areas, it would startle the whole world.
Yeah, so it kind of makes you wonder if, you know, how they could even have a handle on it.
That's why they use the contractors. You know, like they use the security forces in Iraq and Afghanistan, private security forces. That way they don't have to answer to problems. If there's a problem, they can say, oh, we didn't do it, they did it.
Mm-hmm.
Feasible denial.
That's right.
So I'm going to say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And we're coming up onto the second hour into our interview with our special guest, Clifford Clift, who's the head of the International MUFON organization, which is the Mutual UFO Network. And, Clifford, what do you do for MUFON? What is your job?
Well, as international director, I talk to Melody and Katie. And numerous others. I've been on, I really a PR person for MUFON. Do a lot of interviews. I coordinate the office activities for, we have two staff there, and we have memberships that we have to deal with every month, and we have a MUFON store that we have that we sell merchandise, obviously. And making sure that the journal, the monthly journal, is handled properly. I work with the state directors across the United States, and then I have an international director or international deputy that handles the people in South Africa, France, wherever it might, England, wherever it might be. So I have to monitor and work with these folks, and then we have a board of directors of 8 people that are very highly educated and very intelligent people, and they I have to work with them and maintain the financial integrity of the operation. And answer a lot of emails.
So when you said there was like 3,000, was that investigators or members?
That's members worldwide.
Okay.
We have approximately 800 trained field investigators.
Okay, that's right.
There's about 300 that are in training, because we like to have people that are familiar with the investigative process train and mentor the new ones. So that's where we're at with that.
Is there an area where you get more sightings than, say, other places where you would get absolutely none? Where is the most prominent place to see a UFO?
I wish I could answer that, because we would be there with our cameras. No, there is no rhyme or reason. For Hudson Valley, New York was big in the 80s. Phoenix Lights in the 1997 in Arizona. China right now is a hot spot. There's no rhyme or reason of where or why they are, and that's one of the things that we would like to be able to determine, is what motivates these craft to go to a certain area. Now, one of the things that we do know, in the 70s, nuclear bases all over the world were being actively observed by these objects. Just amazing. And bodies of water. They seem to gravitate toward water and electricity. So we have many reports of UFOs seen on or near power plants. Now, not that they're robbing the power, but we've had some reports where they see them sitting on high-powered electrical lines, and they're sparking between the craft and the lines. We have seen they have some capability of having a truncated light, and to explain that would be just like a column, like a laser.
Uh-huh.
And it comes down, and it may stop above the ground, or it may go to the ground. And it may be a foot in diameter from the craft all the way down, no dispersing of the light. It comes straight down onto the ground. We've seen that happen at the nuclear bases.
And it's unknown whether they are giving or taking.
Well,
or just connecting.
Observing. Maybe that's all it is.
Do you observe anything coming out of the... Has anybody had any credible pictures of things coming out of the ocean?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I was... It's strange how many people have seen things. It's very strange. There was a cruise ship, 1,000 people on board, and a good friend of mine was on that cruise ship and said they were all... Most of the people were standing out on the deck. They were traveling across the ocean. And all of a sudden, within 300 feet, this flying saucer came up out of the water, dripped water, and then took off. Just everybody that saw it was that amazed. Strange thing is, nobody talked about it. They ignored it. Now, I don't know what that phenomenon is, but that seems to be what happens a lot of times with people. We have witnesses that have stepped forward, and there were 3 girls, 3 sisters, and they had seen something in the 1950s, and one of them maintained all through her life that they saw a UFO, and it was very close, and it was a gunmetal gray, looked like two pans put together, was within 200 feet of them. And the one gal talked about it all the time. The other two sisters said she was nuts. Well, they're in their 70s now, and they've all three of them now have agreed that, yeah, that did happen, but we were just too stunned to talk about it and afraid to talk about it. Because the one sister asked him, why haven't you talked about this? Till now, said, well.
Do you think maybe the amount of energy they're putting off, I can understand why it would disconnect certain brain waves in regard to connecting to did I see that or did I not?
Right.
And fear, I think, is a great motivator in regard to that.
Yes.
Do you have like psychiatrists or psychologists that work with any of these people that see these things?
Yes, we do. We have an abduction team made it comprised of a psychiatrist, two psychologists, and a medical doctor. And they work a great deal with abductees and also from time to time with people that are just traumatized from what they have seen.
Mm-hmm. So,
in the case of most abductees, are they aware of the craft that they're taken into, or is it a matter that they're just here and then they're in a craft?
Katie, that's kind of a strange thing. We have people that have been contacted, not necessarily abducted, but what leads up to their going on to the craft is different. What we have found through the study, we had a 100 abductees who people believe they were abducted, and another 100 people that never been abducted. So we did the psychological characteristics of these people. And one of the things that was discovered was that the people that were abducted had no higher, they didn't respond to stimulus any higher than anybody else. They weren't neurotic in any way or anything like that. But I'm kind of rambling here, so if you have a question, don't hesitate. But one of the things that we have discovered is that the difference between a contactee and an abductee, a contactee, although he may be out and not remember what happened, goes willingly onto the craft. The abductees seem to wake up on the craft in a room being looked at in some manner.
So in other words, you're saying the contactee may not know that he was abducted or realize that it was as real.
Yeah. No, it was just as real to them. It's
uh-huh.
just that they didn't feel like it was against their will.
So in other words, that they have some way of maybe putting them at ease.
Yeah. Shermer, a case that happened in Nebraska back in the 60s, I believe it was. He was a policeman, and it was in the 60s because he had just been out of Vietnam. It might have been the early 70s, but in that time frame. And he was out checking. He had the duty from like 10 at night to 6 in the morning. And back in those days, it's outside of Omaha. And it was he was out checking a small town, and he was out checking the feedlots because there was a lot of commotion going on out there. And he checked it out. Everything was fine. He went on over to the, got in his car and made sure everything was okay. And he started driving down the road. It looked like an 18-wheeler. The lights from an 18-wheeler were right in front of him. And as he approached, he saw it was sitting on the side of the road, and it wasn't. It was some kind of flying saucer object sitting on the side of the road. Well, the next thing he remembers is it's taking off. Under hypnosis through Leonard Springfield and a couple of others, and the University of Colorado at that time, it was in the late 60s, because The Condon Committee investigated that in Project Blue Book, and they, under hypnosis, what happened is he drove up to this object, and he started to get out of his car, and there was a blue light that came out, and it seemed to keep him from getting out of the car into his gun. Then somebody put their arm on his shoulder and his neck, and it kind of paralyzed him, and then they asked if he would like to come on the craft, and he said yeah, so he got out of the car and went up and got into the craft and talked to the people, or to a person, a being, an ET, whatever, and they showed him a lot of the stuff that was going on the craft and what they could do and what they couldn't do, and then they took him back and put him in his car, and then when he came to, he didn't remember any of this, but he went back and put in the logbook, saw a UFO tonight, and that was the end of it. And the next day, the sheriff then came over and said, hey, I saw your entry in the logbook. What's going on? So he told him what he remembered, and he was such an upright, good guy that the sheriff and everybody believed him. And so they thought, well, we better find out more about this. So that's when the hypnosis aspect of the situation came in. Now, an abductee is taken against their will, and they don't want to go do this. Strange thing. The people that have a negative attitude about life have a negative experience in an abduction case. People that have a positive and a good outlook and say God-fearing people, they have a positive experience.
Do they ever have changed their mind and become people that have a negative attitude that had a good attitude or had a good attitude or a negative
attitude? No, I don't think they changed their personality, Melody. I think meaning the ETs, I don't think they changed their personality. I think that's just, you know, we just sometimes are made the way we are, and that's it.
Now, one of the gentlemen that was at the conference was Robert
Lalu, yes.
Yeah, Lalu. Now, is he involved in some of
this? Yeah, he's the chairman of our abduction committee.
Okay, and so there are really a lot of
documented
cases. Yes, thank you, Katie.
Yes, we have the. Probably right off the top is Shermer, the one I was just telling
you
about.
How do you spell that?
But Travis Walton, Fire mm-hmm. in the Sky fame, Snowflake, Arizona, and Betty and Barney Hill. Those are probably the three most researched and famous cases that nobody can find holes in other than people that hoaxers or people that debunkers that want to, you know. We can debunk anybody about anything, and people that don't believe will have a free rein to debunk. So,
well, that was one of the things that I found when and wanted to is how much is enough evidence?
Yeah,
I want to ask an question about the abductees before we move on.
Okay.
I understand that there's been some research in regard to people who allege they've been abducted. They have elevated levels of the enzyme cretin kinases.
Right. Yes, we've heard that. Now, our team has not done that, Katie, run that kind of blood sampling. We're on such a limited budget because we don't have the funding from grants. It's hard to get a grant from somebody say, yeah, we want to study abductees and UFOs. They look at you, oh, yeah, right. So our finances are limited because of that. And so we can't do the blood work and that type of thing. Unless we have a really significant event, then we do have people that will step forward and fund that.
Do you ever, now in those kind of cases, do you think that's our own government?
That's doing the abductions?
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a lot of, there's not a lot. There's some evidence that that's what's going on. And I think it has to do primarily with some type of mind control that is going on within the military establishment of some degree, somehow, somewhere, some way. But I can't say that there's many cases of that.
And in regard to mind control, are you thinking that people are seeing them and mind control is making them think that they don't? Or that they're using mind control to make them think that they are seeing them?
I'm wondering if this is not a MUFON stance. This is my personal opinion. I think from time to time there are entities within our government. Not entities, that's a bad choice.
agencies?
Maybe not. But there are human beings within our government that really have very few scruples, and in the name of science, they will do anything. Mm-hmm. And look at the LSD that they did back in the 50s and CIA and that type of thing.
And the radio frequencies they're working with now.
Yes, so I'm not saying that they're not above that, and I think that from time to time they will do those things and cause people problem and say, oh yeah, they were abducted, and leave that in their mind. Disinformation is really big within the military.
And that's one of the things that makes me wonder, you know, when you hear about with Leslie Keene talking about the few that are legitimate, that they can explain, I have a tendency to feel like the military or the government would find it much easier to hide behind the other much larger percentage that supposedly is explained and be able to debunk it and use that as a cloaking to hide.
Right. I think you're right. I think that's what they do. As international director of MUFON, what I'm saying is over the airwaves, and I'm quite certain that there are people that would not want me to say what I'm saying, but they know that I have no credible source from General John Doe that led the CIA to do this. They know I don't know that person, so they assume I'm guessing. So I have no fear that they're going to do something to me because I'm espousing this type of information.
And it's a good one to say anyways, to cover yourself anyways.
Good point.
Consider yourself covered.
That's right.
I mean, because when I started, that was one of the funnest thing was just looking at all the different backgrounds of some of these people that attended this conference and some of the work. I haven't even hardly scratched the surfaces of some of these speakers, and I want to look more at Stanton Friedman's work, and he was getting into some of the Stephen Hawking and SETI, and you got
Stanton Friedman, Melody, is probably one of the most well thought of, capable, competent researchers that we have in the UFO field, and he does just an outstanding job. I don't know how he has the time to do all that he does. Goes and spends weeks at a time at a presidential library or the National Archives or these places and digs up all this information. It's really amazing. So, yeah, we are blessed with some great people. Ted Phillips with the Trace Landing, he was a protege of J. Allen Hynek. We have Richard Dolan, a historian. By the way, Stanton Friedman and Richard Dolan and Rob Swiatak and I are speaking in Baltimore at a conference put on by not a UFO group, but an informational group that wants to know more about what's going on. So we'll be speaking out there in November 20th. But
well, there's several that you mentioned there that said they would do interviews, but I haven't been able to get them to say yes yet. So
yeah, Melody, it's a, you got to. Those guys are so busy.
I understand. I have to keep trying.
Well, Ancient Aliens has definitely given them a platform.
It certainly has, Katie. There's just so much information about ancient technology that was used and the sightings that have been done in the Louvre in France. There's pictures painted with UFOs by the great masters that have UFOs in the pictures. This is not just new to us in since the 1940s. This has been going on for a long time.
And what do you think their mission here is?
I think they're just observing. I don't think they're evil or bad any more than, well, there's some bad people on Earth. I'm sure there's probably some bad people in space. But I think as a rule, I think they're pretty understanding and way advanced beyond us. And they probably, you know, they always ask me, well, yeah, if you believe in that, why don't they land on a White House lawn? I said, well, because we'll shoot them.
That's correct.
That's the first thing that we do is if we don't know what it is and where it's from, we're going to shoot it.
And in 1952, when they visited the White House and flew overhead, they rounded up the fighters.
Yes, they had them going out trying to intercept, but they turned the lights out and the radar's off, and they couldn't see them.
Now, I observed, and I haven't had a chance to really confirm this video that I saw just today on the net, where this person, may have been a Dutchman, somebody had shot, and it was actually, you could really see a reasonable object that just, and he followed it from Earth, it looks like Earth, all the way out towards the moon. Have you seen that video at all?
No, I have not.
Yeah, I saw it.
And what did you think, Katie?
Well, I thought it was very impressive. I would have liked to have known what he was shooting it on and what actually depth. This one was at night, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, it was most impressive. And at the same time, I would like to know what he was shooting with to get that.
Well, but what it seemed to reveal to me is if that had, you know, legitimacy, it was like it didn't look like there was much time involved to get to. I mean, it looked like it went to the distance of the moon or beyond.
Well, but we can't tell really distance unless we have something to measure it by.
Well, it looked like it went beyond it. That's why I'm saying that.
Oh, it went beyond it. Now, mm-hmm. That part, I saw that, but I wasn't for sure if it went beyond it or it just disappeared.
Okay.
Got smaller and smaller in one space, because once they're so far out, it's hard to tell if they're turning off the lights or if they're going so fast we really don't visually see how they propelled themselves or
so,
which direction they
so
propelled
Clifford,
themselves.
Do they have ships that can do that, say, because what was that, about a 5 or 10 minute
Yeah,
video?
I think it was 4 minutes and 36 seconds.
Are you aware of anything that fast that could travel?
Well, we don't have anything on this Earth that'll go that fast.
But An asteroid might go that fast.
Well, no, actually, the asteroids have a limited speed. They don't seem to exceed a certain speed, which is strange because we've had UFO sightings at the same time that there's been meteor sightings, and the UFO goes faster than the meteors.
Interesting.
Do you have any film?
No, I don't.
Okay, so, and a lot of the pictures, and I know this, I'm just neophyte on some of this, but some of the pictures that I've observed, I have a hard time feeling that, you know, they could ever be able to see a whole lot. Do you guys get to really view some really good photography?
We have some great pictures of UFOs. We really do. Some of them that they're not just lights. You can actually see the craft. And they have one in Trinidad, not Trinidad, Colorado, but Trinidad, where was it?
South America.
And it was a great, great video, or a great film taken by a professional photographer, and the whole crew saw it. And that's a great picture. Van Heflin photo is another good one, and the one in California taken by the highway engineer. Those are just phenomenal photographs. We have one right now that we're Mark D'Antonio is investigating that happened off the coast of Florida. It was a video, and the craft came in and went back out, and Mark is extremely impressed with this one. But as a rule, what we get are, I had one case in northeastern Colorado, went out and investigated, and it was a gal that took a pic. She was a traffic in charge of the lights on the construction highway work at night in the summer. Excuse me. And she took a picture of what she thought was an alien standing over the top of her generator that was generating the lights for the night work. Well, I investigated that, and I looked, and sure enough, she had the window up on the passenger side, and she took a picture with a flash at night, and it reflected off of the map that was on her seat. It looked like it was standing over the, it was crumpled up in a way that looked like something was standing over her generator. So, yeah, there's a lot of that stuff that we get, and it's pretty weird what people think. You know, when you're out in the middle of nowhere at night, there's a lot of things that make us think, whoa, what's that? I just got hearing aids, and I was out in the checking on some trees in the middle of the night, irrigating is what I was doing, and I started hearing all these noises. Well, these hearing aids now make me hear things I hadn't heard before, and I came back out of that field terrified.
It's a whole new world.
There's a whole new world out there. So, you know, when things happen at night, it does get people a little jumpy and jittery about it. So,
okay, going back to what I asked earlier, is how much is enough evidence?
Okay, we have enough evidence, Melody. We do. We have when you have people, commercial airline pilots that are in charge of 250 people's lives, flying a $100 million aircraft. They are trained observers. They understand what they're seeing. And when they report something that is not another aircraft and it's doing things that's different, that's pretty good evidence. You couple that with radar from the aircraft that is also painting the object, and you have FAA ground radar painting this object, and you have passengers in the plane seeing it, that is really pretty doggone good evidence. It's probably enough to convict somebody of murder if that would be the case in a court of law. When you have three Air Force commercial, like they did in 1952, they had National Airport, and they had Andrews and another one, all three traffic control centers, we're seeing these objects over the Pentagon and Washington, D.C., and the White House had them on radar. They could look out the window and see the same thing. We had commercial pilots coming in reporting these objects. That's pretty strong evidence. So, yeah, we have, when you put physiological effects into that, where there was something that happened to the people that were too close to the object, physically, they were hurt some way or another. There's just too many things like this that happen with the real good sightings that you can't have. The only other evidence you could have is if you have the craft sitting in your garage.
Now, where do you think we are on holographic images for this? Have you run into any of this?
Just at night shows.
Okay, so there's not, I mean, you've not run into anything that might be projected that might make people think we're seeing something that would give a three-dimensional image.
Possible, yes. Probably not.
Okay.
Because I think the technology is so good that they could do that, but I don't know where you would have to have the equipment to do it, how close you would have to have it to where you're wanting the people to see the image or what. And maybe it's that, but I don't think holographic is is going to be a very big factor in this.
Are you familiar with the book, The Report from Iron Mountain?
The name of the book, yes.
Okay. Well, I happened to pick up a copy, and it came out of the Lowry Air Force Library.
Oh, uh-huh.
And which I thought made it kind of a little bit more interesting. And you know, in the first part of it, because I guess there's been quite a number of additions to it, but the first part of it, it, you know, passes it off as a hoax. But when you sit down and you read this thing, and you realize that just about everything that they talk about's been implemented, I have to wonder whether it's a hoax or not.
Right.
And when they get to the part where they want to make this sighting like an Independence Day thing, and we're going to all unite the world under this UFO sighting, it almost makes you have to wonder, and that's why I was kind of asking a little bit on the holographic image.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Now, I do think one of the things, the Robinson panel in the 1950s that was convened by the CIA to come up with a solution to this UFO phenomenon that was going on so prevalent. And, of course, we're in the middle of a Cold War at the time with Russia, and everybody was on edge all the time because people keep calling into the Air Force and the Pentagon and stuff reporting these sightings. It was tying up the telephones. And if there was a real event or something major and significant going on, they may not be able to get through to report it. It's hard to believe that they didn't have cell phones and communications without wires, but yeah, that's the way it was. So, yes, the Robinson panel, one of the things that they said is we've got to make fun of these people, belittle them, and we've got to get the Walt Disney people involved in this so that they can, and other Hollywood's what they said, which meant Walt Disney at the time, involved in this so that the people will quit thinking that they're bad and dangerous and scary and quit reporting them, or they'll be belittled and made fun of. So that's what happened, and that's where the giggle factor really got into the UFOs at that point in time.
When was this panel convened?
Robinson panel, Melody, I would have to get you the exact date, and it was in the 50s.
Okay.
But if you look on Google, look up the Robinson panel.
Okay.
Robertson panel.
Robertson, okay.
Yeah, and look that up. You can come up with a lot of good information on that. As a matter of fact, we have in our archives the document that was classified when it was done, but we'd be able to pick it up, and it's in our archives. It's the procedures.
Well, don't you find that kind of interesting, that why would they go to that point?
They didn't know what else to do. Honestly, they were at a loss. There were things flying in and out of our atmosphere they had no control over. Now, when you're the mightiest military nation in the world, how do you go to the public and say, you know, they do exist, but there's nothing we can do about it? That gives a lot of confidence in our Air Force and government.
Well, do you think that they not at some point in time did they maybe had met up with some of these things coming in and out of the atmosphere? Or is there any kind of evidence that leads to that, or is that something, again, that's been pretty well hidden?
Well, no. I think Roswell really happened. I think the craft is in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. There are other crashes that have happened that the equipment... For an example, they have a group of military people that can be within 4 hours anywhere, I think, in the United States and probably the world, and pick up anything that crashes. Because the technology that these craft have are so far advanced and would make whoever is able to back engineer and develop that technology the rulers of the world.
So... You don't, because somewhere along the line, I guess, what they're trying to pass off to the public now is that they don't really want to have this superiority in the rulers of the world, and yet, with the other hand, they're trying to fight each other. So, we still have that going on, and then you hear them talking about, well, we're got something going on Mars, you know, and whether we do or it's in the works or... is there any kind of evidence to show that they've got something going on off planet?
Not that I'm aware of. It's very strange that after Apollo, was it 13, that they quit going to the moon. Why did that happen? Well, according to some people, we were warned off. And that's a very strong possibility. Now, you guys just stay away. We have evidence and some of the pictures that have come out, and people have come forward from the moon and from, well, not, I don't know about Mars, but from the moon, and on the far side, not the dark side, we think it's the dark side because it's dark to us, but the far side of the moon is light, and they have pictures of all kinds of things that have happened on the other side of the moon, on the far side. So... there's something up there. I don't know. It would kind of make me cringe a little bit to think that there might be a civilization on Mars, or there may have been on the moon, or there is on the moon. I don't know. That would be a little different.
Because some of the photography that we're seeing of these pictures of Mars, you see real detailed things if it's really up close. You know, and you're looking at some little tiny object, but then they don't really give us some really good pictures of you know, things that make you wonder from a distance.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's very strange why that happens. Why are the pictures that NASA has released of the moon 30 years old? And some of them, I went all the way around the moon, longitude and latitude, every 10 degrees, looking at the pictures that were taken, 30 years ago. And you can definitely tell some of them were airbrushed out. We have people that were in the Air Force that said that they did brush those out. So there's something up there on the moon and Mars that... they may not be there now. They were there at one time, or they will be there.
Okay, now when they talk about whether the government will disclose, I'm still kind of wondering what happened to the people that were involved with the disclosure project and why it kind of backed off.
Okay, that's really good. That is an excellent question. The people that say that disclosure is just around the door, I think it's a pipe dream, because the information that was given out, what, a month or two ago at the press club in Washington, D.C., on disclosure, where military people from nuclear bases got up and talked about the activity and the types of things that are going on.
Now, that one I missed. I'll have to go. That was at the press club?
I believe it was the press club, and it was like a month ago,
okay.
Maybe 2 months. And these guys came out and told all kinds of stuff. Well, we heard nothing from the government. They can't come in and say, well, that never happened. Because they've got these credible military people that work for them saying that it happened. And as they said, if they come out and say anything, it's incriminating.
So, but we don't need the military, is what I'm trying to, I think I'm trying to say here. Because if we got enough people that are disclosing on their own, why do they need, you know, why did they back down?
I don't think they do, Melody. I think they just they don't back down.
Well, the publicity, it just went away.
Yeah. And then that's the best thing that could happen for the U.S. Air Force. It just go away.
So somebody's a gatekeeper in that group.
You bet they are.
Okay. So, I think I have some suspicions of who they could be, too.
Yeah, and it could be that they're not contacting the government because they don't like them.
That's a good possibility. I would be very concerned contacting some of the generals or the top political figures. I'm not sure I trust enough of them enough to. And I think they're sophisticated. They know what our intelligence level is and what our intentions are.
If witnessing a landing and there is nobody around, what evidence could somebody pick up in regard to giving you information?
Well, first of all, there is usually radioactivity involved with a landing,
so
to some
dirt.
Degree. It's best not to be involved with that because it could have a significant effect on the a physical effect on the person. The best thing to do if there's a landing is just get back away from it, mark it, know where it is, and then go report it to MUFON or report it to 911 and get the.
Now, come on. Now, if you were really going to report one, would you want to go to 911?
Well, the first responders usually are the best ones there. I gave a talk to 100 deputy sheriffs about UFOs and what to expect if there's a landing or what to expect if there's a crash. And the one thing that I tell them immediately is that you're the first responder. You'll be out there wherever this event happens. Be careful of the radioactivity, and these are some things to look for. But I said within 4 hours, the U.S. Air Force will be there, and you'll be relegated to traffic control and told that a top-secret plane crashed, and that's the end of the story. Don't talk about it. So that's what happens. If one landed out here in my field tonight, well, within 3 or 4 hours, it would be cordoned off, and it would be classified as some secret.
So you guys have to tell the Air Force, too?
No, we don't have to tell the Air Force.
So then if we reported to you, then we could avoid that?
Yeah. Well, we have tried to get to be the reporting agency for the FAA, but we didn't have big enough bucks to do that, and Mr. Bigelow with Bass Aerospace is now the first person that's contacted, because he has an investigative crew that are of scientists that go out. So, but yeah, it's if one of them did land or crash, don't get too close to it because there may be some radioactivity that could be of a detriment to a person's health. And until we can, now we have hazmat suits and we have Geiger counters and other things that we our STAR team investigators have that they can go out to the site and check it out, make sure everything's okay.
So, does
are you able to actually take a look at a spot that, say, something landed at 5 years ago and take readings?
Katie, there is some of that available. 5 years is a pretty long time, but the Delphos, Kansas incident of a landing, and that was, what, I don't know, 20 years ago or more, there's still a round circle there in the ground where nothing is still growing. So one of the things that we do, we have three labs that we work with, and if there is a landing case, we will go out and make grids of the area and then take soil samples every foot all the way out to maybe half a mile to a mile. Not every foot for that far, but within the immediate area, every foot, soil samples to have them analyzed. One of the things that we find is that you guys are in Salida, so you're probably familiar with some of the mining activity, but...
I'm in Colorado Springs in the shadow of Cheyenne Mountain.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, you're safe then.
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, so, okay. Well, anyway, magnetite is an iron oxide, and at the center of a landing site, the magnetite is more, there's more of it there than anywhere else because it's magnetic. So what we're thinking is there is some electromagnetic field involved with the craft that landed that would draw this magnetite into, from the soil into that area. So that's one of the things that we look for, too, is magnetite, to see if, in fact, there is some electromagnetic forces involved.
And are, is that the same type thing that is found with crop circles?
I have heard that crop circles do have some magnetite in them, but I haven't. I don't know of anybody that has done the study on that, or if they have, I haven't read it. But it wouldn't surprise me.
Do they find any genetic modifications around any of those crop circle fields or anything?
Well, other than things don't grow.
Okay, all right. And so then at the landing sites might be the same way?
Well, I'm sorry, yes, the landing sites. That's what I'm thinking is that
okay.
Seldom do you find crops that will grow in a landing site. If the now there's different, that's not, I shouldn't say that, make it sound like that's always the case, but in many of the cases it is.
Okay, now, and again, is there any of these sightings that you found evidence from that has made you really think that is us? More so than it would be extraterrestrial.
Well, that's a tough question because I might be able to answer it if I knew better what you were saying, but
okay, when I guess when, say like you had a bunch, you know, somebody you had a bunch of them you'd had gone out and looked at and you start getting enough evidence out there that makes you realize that the technology may be there, that it may be us, and
Okay. Well, no, because in many of the landing instances, Melody, what happens is there are three tripod indentations in the soil. And what we can tell the weight of the craft by compaction analysis of the soil. We know what the soil is outside of the indentation. We know how much compaction is there, and then we take it inside, and we can calibrate and determine the weight of the object that was left those indentations. And when I was talking about a 25-ton craft, that seems to be a lot of what happens. They're estimated to be 25 to 30 ton.
Now, there's some of these instances out there, some of them maybe, I mean, because it seems like we have, I didn't see you bring up South America much, but there seems to be a lot of sightings that come out of Mexico and South America.
South America is an incredible spot for activity, UFO activity. Brazil, Peru, Argentina, Chile, these countries, Mexico, obviously, they just have an amazing amount of UFO activity.
So do you have a lot of investigators down there?
No, we don't have at this current time. We sometimes we make people mad at us because we're an investigative and we do a scientific study of the UFO phenomenon. And our science sometimes conflicts with emotions of people. So if we can scientifically prove that something is extraterrestrial or that it's terrestrial, that doesn't fit with the paradigm of the witness. And so sometimes we're not well thought of even in the United States or foreign countries because we tell it like we do, like we find out scientifically.
So, like an instance like in the Billy Meyer thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
A Billy Meyer case happened in Switzerland. We've been beat up on the internet about the Billy Meyer case, but we were never asked to investigate. We don't just, if my neighbor over here says he saw a UFO, and I would say, would you like for an investigation of this? And he says, no, we don't investigate it. That's what happened with Billy Myers, and that's what happened with Stan Romanoff. We asked to investigate. Nope, don't want you to do that.
Huh.
So, okay, we don't do it.
And Dan was actually out of Denver, Colorado, wasn't he?
Pardon me?
Was it Dan Romanoff? His
Dan Romanoff, yeah.
He was outside of Denver, correct?
Yeah, uh-huh. So, you know, if people don't want us there, we don't go. And we keep anonymity of our witnesses. If they don't want their name disclosed to the public, then we don't do that.
So what about if you have a lot of sightings around some place like Dulce or whatever you call it, pronounce that name?
Dulce, yeah.
Dulce?
Yeah.
Do you guys have anything that ties in with that area?
Well, yeah, we do. Now, when you talk Dulce, you're talking public domain. We can investigate that. But if Joe Smith from Dulce has a tremendous sighting but doesn't want us to investigate it, then we can work the parameters or the outside area, but we can't go in directly to do what he wants if he doesn't want us to investigate what he's done. Dulce is we keep hearing all kinds of things about underground bases, and there's disinformation from the Air Force on that. There's positive information from witnesses, and it's a real dilemma, but there may be something there and may not be either.
Well, when you see some of the machines that they're making, like that tunnel in the Alps, and then they make the thing under the channel, and some of the pictures that I've seen of these machines, I can't imagine them not doing much with that.
You can't imagine what?
That they're not making a lot of things. They're not making a lot of these underground.
Oh, you know. Certainly, yeah. There's certainly underground bases all across the United States for nuclear disasters where the hierarchy will all be able to go to, and the military, that type of thing. But the big problem is these big machines. When you take a pound of dirt out in front of you, and you want to leave a hole, that dirt's got to come out the back.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to build a 30-foot hole in the side of a mountain, there's going to be some debris brought back out of there, and it's going to go somewhere, so people will know. You can look at all the mine tailings up through the mountains. If you take something out, it goes all the way out if you want to go in any further. So there's going to be that. There'll be a telltale sign of something left over from the hole, and there would also be a great deal of noise and vibration.
What about the Denver airport? And
oh, that's such a... I'm sorry. I'm personal friends with the manager of all the underground activity at DIA. He's a big engineer. And I asked him, I said, you know, I keep hearing that there's tunnels down there. He says, yeah. He says, we've got tramways. The trains go in and out, and we have places to take cables in and out underground. And he says, but that's the only thing that I ever saw, and I was in charge of it. So he said, there's no tunnel going from there to Colorado Springs.
Okay. Well, that helps clear that one up.
They sure got a lot of dirt piled up on the other side of DIA and they keep adding to it.
It's trash. Where do you think all that trash from DIA goes?
Ah, so they're building mountains of trash.
That's right.
So if anybody would like to become a member of MUFON or report a sighting, they can go to your website at MUFON.com, or they can give you a call at 888-817-2220. And from there, they can get to just about any information, correct?
That's exactly right. And we need more investigators and better trained investigators. We'll train them, but we need investigators, and you have to be a member of MUFON to become one. And when you do that, then we've got a lot of activity that we can put your way. I have one investigator right now, Melody and Katie and Greeley, that's got six cases that she's trying to investigate because we don't have enough investigators up here.
Wow. Now, well, we got this San Luis Valley. Do we have anybody down there?
Let's see. We have some ufologists down there, but we don't. I don't know if we have any members of MUFON down there.
Well, isn't Chris O'Brien involved?
Chris O'Brien. He contacts us once in a while with some good things. There's a lot of activity down there.
For a very long time.
Yes, forever and ever. The Peaceful Valley.
Well, I always kind of wondered it might be make a good place to also test out certain things if you... So there's... Because I have talked to people that have seen some pretty interesting, explainable things on some of them. Some of them you don't know, but... I imagine it's all over, but I do know that I have seen tons of stuff coming out of South America, and it's too bad that that we don't have that connection.
Well, we're working. Ruben Yuarte, as I told you, is our deputy for international relations, investigators, and that type of thing. He's working pretty hard with the people, A.J. Girard, in Brazil, and we're trying to get them set up to be part of our group. So hopefully that'll happen. If it does, we'll be able to report more about what the activity is there.
You know, what conferences do you have coming up?
Well, 2011 will be in Orange County the end of July, and that's the only one that MUFON International is putting on.
So there's state ones that take place.
But there'll be state ones, yeah. We have a UFO meeting in Greeley. About 40 people attend, and that's every other month. And then the state of Colorado has a meeting in Denver, I think once a month on a Saturday morning or afternoon. So we try to have meetings at least once a month to maybe twice a month or twice bimonthly. And that's pretty much across the country.
Now, well, I got to do an interview with Wendell Stevens. Are you familiar with him?
Oh, yes. Did you get to talk to him?
Yeah, I did.
He's passed.
Yeah, I know. I was really bummed.
Well, that was nice that you were able to talk to him before he went to UFO heaven.
Because, I mean, what happened to his picture collection? Does anybody know?
I think Open Minds has that.
And Open Minds is what?
That's a group out of Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay.
And I think they bought all of Wendell Stevens' papers and pictures.
Because he supposedly had an incredible collection from...
Yes, he did. As a matter of fact, Open Minds made a book out of it. There's two volumes with pictures information about the picture.
Uh-huh. And did he have his work was some of them are you know real good evidence?
Yes, he does. Wendell had some very good things and some things that like the rest of us have that suspect, but he had a lot of great things.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, go ahead, Katie.
What do you see as the future of MUFON?
Well, you know, if disclosure happened, we'd probably be out of business. But I don't think it's going to happen. And I think that what's going to happen is we're going to become more sophisticated. And because of technology, more able to get to a scene of an event quicker. And from that, we will be able to ascertain more scientific information as to what the craft's doing and how it's doing it and why. And that's really the benefit to humanity is what we're up to. And if we can discover the propulsion system that drives these machines, it would just be an absolute blessing to this whole Earth. We wouldn't be so dependent upon oil and gas and coal and nuclear power and that type of thing.
Well, you know, Clifford, it looks like it's time coming to a close. And if you have any closing comments, but I also want to say that I thoroughly enjoyed the interview. And thank you for coming on our program, and I hope we can do this again sometime.
Melody, I'd love to do that. It's been nice talking to you and Katie, and I've enjoyed your questions. They were very insightful and very thoughtful and very intelligent, so I appreciate talking to people like yourself.
Well, thank you
for being on the show. It was a delight.
Yes, good. Thank you very much, you guys. You take care.
Okay, thank you.
Have a good week.
Okay, goodbye.
Okay, bye.
Okay, again, this is KHEN LP 106.9 Salida, and that was an interview with Clifford Clift with MUFON, as he says. And I'm going to try to check in here in just a moment, and so I'll put a song on the radio, and I'm going to try to check in with Jeff Peckman and Larry Bryant, who are up in Denver after the election, because a few weeks ago I did an interview with both of them on the setting up of the extraterrestrial commission that was put on the ballot as a ballot initiative up in Denver. So in the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and play a song here if I get it right. Here. Okay.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments are killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun, or a brick, or a stone. And there are lies in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children out of the can. There is blood on the wire.
Jeff Peckman and Larry Bryant, who I did an interview with a few weeks ago, and this has been after the election for the Denver ballot initiative on setting up an extraterrestrial commission. Are you there, Jeff?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great. And I thought maybe we could kind of get some election results on how this turned out in Denver and all the little things that go on behind the scenes that are involved with this project.
Okay, as far as the election results, it seems that there's about a 16 or 17% yes vote, and the rest is a no vote on Initiative 300. And we knew that this was going to be difficult because it's a new topic that is being presented to people who, for their entire lives, for the most part, have been conditioned to think that we're alone in the universe, that there really aren't any extraterrestrial visitors to this planet, despite all the evidence to the contrary. And so they're facing this for the first time, And we were faced with some very unusual, unique obstacles, one being that the Denver budget management director grossly overestimated what the costs would be that were reimbursable. He had already confirmed that the commission itself would not cause any cost to the city of Denver, to the taxpayers, but there might be some indirect costs that could be reimbursed. The amount that he came up with was about 10 times more than it should have been. So that was one thing. Also, the Denver Democratic Party was neutral on Initiative 300, but at the same time, they had this massive campaign, advertising campaign going on to encourage everybody to vote no on all numbered initiatives. And we know for a fact that there were some people who voted no on Initiative 300 because they thought that that's what the Denver Democratic Party wanted, when it wasn't. They were neutral on it. So those two things by themselves caused a serious blow to the numbers at the polls. However, we feel totally at peace and victorious in the sense that we brought this issue to the forefront, something that other countries are taking very seriously. Our country is not yet in any visible way from the government side, so we as the citizens took this on as a task because we felt that it had to start somewhere, even if it had to start in as a local ordinance, that was at least a beginning to disclosure that we are being visited by extraterrestrial intelligent beings.
Now, we just did an interview with Clifford Clift of MUFON. And one of the things, when I attended the MUFON symposium this summer, that it seemed like that a lot of those people that were involved with the on the panel didn't really think disclosure would come about. Now, my question is, disclosure by who? Because it, obviously there is being things disclosed, and maybe not by the military. Are you following me?
I am, and very often people only think of disclosure as something where the federal government shares what it knows about its UFO files, its information on extraterrestrial visitors. They think only in terms of that. I think of disclosure as what you hinted at, information about this reality being shared by whoever has the information with everybody that is, you know, open to listening to it. And I think this kind of local disclosure is disclosure with a capital D, because if it comes from the federal government, there's going to be so much political motivation behind every word of any statement about this that I think it diminishes the value of disclosure. So we believe that this is a task that is going to be very effective at a local level. New York City, there's somebody already intending to have this same initiative in New York City, and along with that, perhaps a UFO Woodstock type of concert themed around UFOs and extraterrestrial visitors with many of the top names in music that have a strong interest in this. So, if nothing else, this ballot initiative in Denver has jump-started what could be a really huge impact from something in New York City, but we've already made a huge impact here, and we've got the issue in front of people.
Okay, now I've got two questions here then. Is one of them being that, okay, where in outside of this country are they setting up some sort of commission? Is it getting any kind of legs? And, you know, again, we talk about UFOs, but how about disclosing the real technology that's out there that may be observable and just on the side of the terrestrial?
Well, you know, I believe that some of that is going to start surfacing. There's going to be an acceleration of a release of that kind of technology, whether it seems to be entirely human-designed or with the assistance of extraterrestrial intelligence, that will start seeping into the market more quickly now. And nothing is going to create this whole paradigm shift all at once. It's going to be many different people, many different programs, many different jumps, collectively moving us forward as a society, as a race of human beings, so that we can be welcomed into the galactic community. So I feel very optimistic. And we had a wonderful event this evening, 15 or 20 people, campaign supporters, and we're all at peace with this. Naturally, people like to, you know, have a higher percentage at the polls, but that's a small component of what is a very big momentum towards disclosure, and we've loaned a lot to that through our efforts here. And if you just look at the news reports on this, if you look at the number of websites that come up with Initiative 300 or Extraterrestrial Affairs Commission, it's huge. It's growing exponentially.
So you got, and what was the percentage again, and are you getting much press with this?
Well, I just finished an interview with the Associated Press this evening, also with someone at the Denver Post, and I think Denver Daily News, and tomorrow morning will be AOL News. So, yes, they'll report on it, and the issue is not over with, because there's a question as to whether or not this official in the Denver City government actually broke any laws in coming up with this grossly exaggerated and misrepresentation of facts. So that's just something that we have to look into. But overall, we're just watching the news right now and seeing the percentage is around 16 or 17% yes vote, and that the almost, I think, 98% of the precincts have reported. So it seems to be pretty clear which way this is going, and I don't have any doubt about that. We just had a very wonderful, enjoyable exchange of congratulations this evening, because we have been victorious in bringing a lot of attention to this issue and getting it discussed in the schools and the colleges, within especially the Latino community in Denver, because of Veronica Barella's support, and she's a real mover and shaker that, you know, a lot of people owe their political careers to. So this is one step, but she's already thinking of the next step. She's just that kind of very progressive person.
And how about, you know, these sort of commissions around the world? Is there any that's been...
Oh, yes, I got sidetracked. we know that at the national level, there are many other governments that are already starting to release their UFO files. In Argentina, there was a conference recently, and there was a packed room, sold-out room, to hear one of the exopolitics experts. The European Union, there was a declaration put forth back in June to try to get all the European Union nations to disclose what they know about UFOs. And again, when I'm saying UFOs, I'm talking about craft that seems to be pretty obviously not from this planet, not just every fuzzy light that, you know, somebody doesn't know what it is. So there are efforts. Russia, China seems to be moving forward quite quickly in certain ways. So there's a huge amount, and I think as that unfolds, people in Denver are going to look back at this initiative and think, oh my gosh, you know, we had a chance to be on the forefront of this, and we were misinformed by our own budget director, by the Denver Democratic Party, by opponents who were, you know, spreading misinformation. So we all have a very clear conscience, and we're just thrilled to be part of this whole initiative. And Larry W. Bryant is with me right now, and he was quite thrilled about it as well. We were just talking about this, so I'd be happy to put him on the phone.
Go ahead.
Okay, here
we go. Thank you, Jeff.
Hello, this is Larry W. Bryant sitting here watching the election returns on this TV set here. I came in here on Monday to take part in watching the play out of history on this subject.
And you've been a go-getter on this whole thing. And so you kind of came out from the East Coast to come here and watch this whole thing take place, correct?
Yes, you know, the initiative itself started out with collecting 4,000 signatures on a signature petition submitted to the city council for, review and acceptance. 4,000 voters in the city of Denver decided that this was a worthy topic for a ballot initiative. And guess what? Four times that many had decided that they would favor the proposed ordinance. And so we're right in justifying our assumption that our efforts were very positive from start to finish.
But if I recall correctly, Jeff saying that there might have been a little bit of a problem in the way they lined things up and the way they were advertising this initiative, or the initiative got caught up in some of the no votes on the numbered initiative ballot amendments. Is that correct? Or
the estimation of the cost to the city to administer the ordinance requirements. There would be not negligible, or if any cost, it would be very small. And the budget director, for whatever reason, came up with a figure that was totally irregular. And so we think that this was one factor that caused us to receive no more than 16% of the votes, 16% in favor, against 84 who said, no, we don't want this ordinance passed.
Did they have any projections of what they thought it might do? If
Well, you know, I was speaking to Jeff about this, that the state of Colorado has a Freedom of Information Act, also known as an Open Records Act, that I'm planning to file a request under that act to get from the budget office all the records that pertain to decision-making on this business of how much is it going to cost the taxpayers to administer the conduct of the proposed commission. And if those records show any irregularity at all, then we have a case for filing a petition for redress, you might say, with the authorities on this, because budget directors aren't allowed to play footsie with budget projections. They have to be accurate as possible, and we wonder if this guy actually did any real computations at all, and if so, what was the logical basis for those computations? So this is one aspect of how we plan to follow up the what we view as a success for increasing public awareness of UFO activity and the UFO ET presence throughout the world. Another offshoot of this, of course, is that this positive turnout of the vote is going to help us have moral support for what might occur in New York City when a comparable project gets underway with the help of a longtime UFO researcher named Mike Luckman. So, you know, it's a good time to be ufologically alive. We are participating at a grassroots level, and this is where we're going to have a major paradigm shift in how the public views the prospects for UFO contact and extraterrestrial interaction.
Well, you know, I really want to thank you guys for... Unless there's more you want to add here, I want to thank you guys for coming on and kind of giving us an update on how this election has turned out. And if, maybe I'll check in again with you on at some point here if there's any other major developments.
Well, we would be happy to talk to you again, especially if there's some progress being made in New York City to get the city council to go ahead and institute a commission just patterned after the one that we created a model for right here in Denver. So stay tuned is all I can tell you, Melody. And I appreciate you calling us back. And who knows? We may even have more positive news next time.
Okay. Well, thanks again. Again, Jeff and Larry. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you very much, Melody.
And thank you, Jeff. And like I said, just keep me updated on what's going on with these initiatives and if there's anything more newsworthy with this particular election.
All right. I sure will.
Okay. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you. Good night.
Okay, that was Jeff Peckman and Larry Bryant, who had were just celebrating a
a reasonable success. I mean, that sounds about as good as it did with some of the prior elections on the third party candidate. So, I mean, the first time it's done, it's. I wouldn't say that they. It sounds to me like they did reasonably well. It wasn't winning, but it definitely shows that there's an interest out there for some this ballot initiative.